Okay.
All right. Very good. I'm
Manfred
Mueller, and I will be talking about the question, should you choose one or more clinical specialties in homeopathy? I would like to make this a brief presentation and a good long discussion, because I feel like it's often through questions that we raise that we can come to the truth of something, and it's not really about, this is not about my opinion. It's about some of the thoughts I've had over the years. I've myself practiced homeopathy for 35 years, and all of it as a what we call a professional homeopath, even before professional homeopaths existed. So when I started my practice, I was felt rather alone and did not get much support from other homeopathic organizations. I was very happy when I found that NASH was formed, and also other attempts to recognize professional homeopaths were made. But this is not what we're going to talk about. Incidentally, in the title, I have a
I'm getting a lot of feedback from something.
Terrible echo. Can we do something about that, or can we call back and choose another number, or what should we do?
I don't know if we can choose another number that allows us to record.
Would we be able to have everyone mute their phone? Would that be helpful?
We can do that. If you press *6, you can mute your phone. So let's do that now.
Okay, of course, I'm not going to mute, but you should unmute yourself when you make a comment or ask a question. Okay, let's continue. I do want to say something briefly about myself. I have been president of the North American Society of Homeopaths for the past 10 years. I recently stepped down as president. According to the NASH bylaws, I am required to stay on for another year as chairman of the board, which I'm happy to do. As you can see from the title, I was asking in the question about clinical specialties, and that gets me to the differentiation of clinical homeopathy versus what other kind of homeopathy do we have? Well, we have what some people refer to sometimes as classical homeopathy. I don't like this term exactly because I feel like it is a misleading, because there's certainly a lot of clinical homeopathy in the classical area of homeopathy, and certainly Hahnemann practiced clinical homeopathy, and many others homeopaths in the 19th century. So-called classical homeopathy, as the term is often used today, is actually an outgrowth of the Kantian approach to homeopathy, or you could say post-Hahnemannian approach to homeopathy. I will not go into the details of this. Well, more important, I see currently there are three types of homeopathy being practiced in North America. The first one is what I call the combination homeopathy. It's a mixture. It's a mix of homeopathy that many people learn some homeopathy, and they fit it in along with other healing arts, such as acupuncture, such as psychology, psychotherapy, many other alternative forms of treatment. Then also they use different methods such as kinesiology, or they use a kind of method of just using a combination remedy to address certain conditions. So that's one kind of homeopathy that's widely practiced by many, many practitioners. Of the trained homeopaths, there is, I think, two different types of homeopathy. The homeopathy that centers on the whole person, the patient, and also often more the mind of the person than so much the conditions that person has. And then the other kind, the clinical, which is homeopathy that centers on the conditions, the disorders, as they're defined from a specific origin. Usually some kind of cause can be identified, or at least a chronological point can be identified when the symptom group develops. And there's usually more than one symptom groups if you differentiate from the beginning of when the symptoms first started. So these are two different ways of looking at homeopathy, and of course Hahnemann went at length into how he defines disease, and he talked about the similium to the disease more than 400 times in the Organon. I know Kim Alia and Will Taylor have gone extensively in explaining this Hahnemann point of view. When I talk about clinical specialties in homeopathy, I'm actually talking about something even slightly different from that. When I say clinical specialties, I'm talking about practice, because that has to do with why people actually seek out homeopathy. And I do feel like some people come to homeopathy because they have a clinical problem, and they may not understand immediately someone who then, a homeopath who then makes the person, the whole patient, the center of this question or this issue. And that may need some more clarification too. But this is just the definition of terms here. We will get into detail later. So clinical specialties in homeopathy could include something like in traditional medicine, such as cardiology or oncology, neurology, psychology, psychiatry, etc. Certainly homeopathy has all of the above, or covers all of the above specialties. The other issue is, or the other possible clinical specialty that one could imagine would be something that you particularly like a disorder that you know more about than others, based on circumstances or based on preferences. Some people really feel interested in one area of medicine, one area of treatment, such as, issue of gastrointestinal disorders. It may be because you have personal experience with that, or it may be because you had particular success in treating a group of disorders in that area. So that's another way of looking at it. And then there's finally the single condition that is diagnosable, or that has been defined in conventional medicine or in medical science, shall we say, as a syndrome. So let's use the very common, now very common condition, autism. Autism is on the rise in the United States and many other countries. And I think it's perhaps the single most common condition that I've seen people say that they specialize in. And this is only in my own private conversation with practitioners. So people like autism because it's a very common disorder. That means there's plenty of need for treatment for autistic individuals. And also, in homeopathy, especially if you're a professional homeopath, where the protection of the practitioner is somewhat of an issue and subject to question sometimes, meaning the legal protections as well as other protections, practitioners tend to look for specialties, if they chose one, that is rather safe. In other words, you cannot do a lot of damage when you treat autistic children compared to other disorder. Let's say if you chose cardiology, first of all, you'd be dealing often with middle-aged people, sometimes elderly people even, more likely that have heart disorders. Of course, there's also juvenile heart disorders, but the issue is also you can die from a heart disorder. So the practitioner could get into trouble if even one patient died after homeopathic treatment. We wouldn't want to do this. So I'm not saying we shouldn't, but some people might not want to do this. It may be a consideration in one's choice. But before we go into all of this, is, should we choose one or more clinical specialties, aside from the fact that many people actually do choose one or more clinical specialties, sometimes even not on purpose. It simply turns out that way. They may have had some success, and then referrals come in, and more referrals come in. And this happened to me with one condition. I had some success with the homeopathic treatment of minimal change disease. Minimal change disease is a peculiar designation for what's often known as nephrotic syndrome. Nephrotic syndrome is a disorder of children. It affects more likely than not children, and many times suddenly, without apparent cause, kidney disease shows up. The diagnostic test is a protein in the urine, and the cause is believed to be either autoimmune or infectious. The disorder responds to homeopathic treatment very well, and I've had some very good success, and after a few people had good success with their children, I had people send other patients or clients to me who also did very well. So I ended up treating quite a few of these families and working with many families who had children with that disorder. So that's an example of how sometimes circumstances choose a specialty for you. But it's purely coincidence. It had nothing to do with anything. There's no reason why that disorder should be any more successful than any other disorder. And I had many, many times success with other disorders and never got a referral, a second referral or whatever. So once we have looked at the possibility of specialties, we should ask ourselves, how does that fit into our view or our philosophy of homeopathy? And that is really an interesting question. And that's why this whole thing is raised as a question rather than simply, I'm going to tell you what works or what doesn't work. That's really not what this is about. If we think of homeopathy as a holistic treatment, a treatment that puts the patient first and the disease second, which is often what you hear in homeopathic presentations, how does specialization fit in? In other words, if you were to focus on a special group of disorders, would you not neglect the big picture? Would you not neglect the patient here? My answer to this is no, absolutely not. In every case, do you need to look at the patient, the whole person. You need to look at the big picture. And it does not really matter what particular disorder you end up focusing on for example, in your knowledge. You really are not deviating from Hahnemannian, from the Hahnemannian perspective, or even from the Kantian perspective. You still look at the whole patient in the sense that you understand how a smaller group of symptoms that began at a specific time fits into the entire whole of the symptomatology. You also look at it from the point of view of what happened in the history. That means in the chronological development of disorders. So for example, we often see that symptoms of chronic disorders begin in one area and then move, new symptoms develop in another area. Especially in older patients, we can look at a whole history of development. And not uncommonly do we see that the suppression of symptoms in one area through conventional medications, of course, allopathic medicine tends to focus on suppressing vital functions. That means symptoms. Ultimately, that suppression then drives the disorder into a new area. So we need to understand that. We need to see this. Always look at this fact. But that should not prevent us from choosing a one particular specialty that we focus on. So, for example, if you chose to make nephrotic syndrome your specialty, in this case, you have chosen a child's disorder or children's disorder. The same disorder can also exist in older patients, but it's called something different and usually has different causes, so it's really not the same disorder. But the same exact disorder is being described as kidney disease, and in children it is simply believed to be an outgrowth of an autoimmune reaction or an autoimmune response. So when we have this kind of disorder and we look at the symptoms, we often find entirely healthy children. In other words, there's no other clinical issues. Of course, we know as homeopaths that there are certain constitutional characteristics. And of course, that's what we look for when we try to address these issues. However, with constitutional issues, we are often find ourselves with very little to go by. With the condition itself, however, there's a clear-cut clinical defined group of symptoms. Swelling of the face, swelling of the rest of the body, sometimes swelling of the arms and legs, and specifically one more symptom that can only be verified through laboratory exams, and that is the high protein in the urine. What are we going to do with that as a syndrome? Very little. There are a few homeopathic remedies that work with this condition, however. And constitutional treatment and the homeopathic remedy can be combined, or the homeopathic remedy for clinical condition can be combined by alternating the constitutional remedy and the clinical remedy. The first time I came across this method, I was sitting in Dr. Francisco Izziaga's class somewhere in the mid-1980s. And I saw him do this, and he called it a terrain remedy and a disease remedy. I thought that was a very interesting approach to treatment. He used the centesimal potencies, and there was a little bit of a drawback. Of course, the centesimal potency for the terrain remedy was often a higher potency, and then the clinical symptoms would be addressed with a lower potency, such as a 6C in repetition, and an occasional dose of a higher potency in 30C. Very rarely would Dr. Izziaga go up over 30C. I have, over the past 25 to 30 years, experimented with the approach of Q potencies. I find the Q potencies very suitable for this kind of treatment because they don't have the problem of antidoting other potencies. In other words, they last in their duration. The clinical effects, the effects of the remedy last longer than that of the C potency. So when you have two remedies that you alternate, you find that they don't counteract each other. Unless, of course, they are known to be inimical or actually antidote each other, in which case you would not, of course, choose those remedies. So this is just one example of how one might focus on a disorder in homeopathy while still addressing and focusing on the whole person. When we look at the homeopathic the situation of homeopathy in the world, I would say my own thoughts on this is homeopathy is an incredibly effective treatment for health problems. Or we could
I have a question for you, Manfred.
Yes.
Do you mind if I ask it now, or do you want me to hold it?
No, I can wait. This is before I go on to some new idea here.
So how would you decide with that approach when to use those two, you know, two approaches, terrain and clinical remedy, you could, you know, how do you decide when to do that? You might find, for example, that the symptom that is the main symptom, but it could also be covered by the terrain remedy. But would you still give two alternating remedies?
No. Your object, of course, has to be that symptoms are covered. So if you can cover it with a terrain remedy, that would be great. So, for example, in the example I was just using, the nephrotic syndrome, the most common clinical remedy or disease remedy is Apis mellifica. But very rarely do the clients, the children, match Apis as a constitutional remedy. Hardly ever happens. Invariably, they match more some much more common remedy like pulsatilla or like Podium nux vomica, what have you. So, if you gave those remedies, yes, they may match some of the symptoms, but they don't really match this exact syndrome, the combination of specific swelling and high protein in the urine. And very rarely have I seen, I've tried it, believe me, I've seen a broad polycrest solve this problem. But then Apis would solve it. So that's an example where you would use a combination of a clinical and, you could say, constitutional approach. In the case of more complex specialization, suppose you were specializing in seizures, neurology. And seizures is a good disorder because seizures are often accompanying other conditions. Sometimes seizures can accompany simply puberty. Sometimes seizures can accompany gastrointestinal conditions. Again, at other times, seizures accompany clearly neurological damage or neurological disorders. So when you address the symptoms of the seizures, and of course you also have a good idea of a general remedy, coming back to your question, Basil, then often you will find yourself with more than one remedy. I've also seen the same thing with emergency treatment. I have published some cases of hemorrhage, where hemorrhaging was an issue. And that's an example of a clinical case, right? You have, subarachnoid hematoma. And at the same time, you have very little information about the characteristics that we generally think of, characteristics of the constitution. You get, of course, what information you can get, but the constitutional remedy often aggravates in situations like that because it's actually dissimilar to the clinical disorder that has developed here. And so in these cases, it is advantageous to start out without the general remedy, in my experience. So you would simply address the seizures, or you would simply address the hemorrhage, in this case a brain hemorrhage, and address this issue, like in treatment of post-stroke is a good example. You have paralysis after stroke. So there's clearly specific clinical remedies that match the symptoms of the paralysis. It may be left-sided. Specific functions may be impaired, like let's say the function of speech may be impaired. The function of swallowing. You need to find a remedy that covers these symptoms the best. And so the remedies you chose may be completely different from what you would choose to cover the constitutional remedy for that person. And again, in fact, I've done probably 20 years or so of that kind of homeopathy, even attempting that the constitutional remedy in such cases without success. And that's after having very good success with constitutional remedies in other cases. So, and of course, when you read our literature, that's pretty much what clinical homeopathy has been for the past 200 years. In many cases, the remedies chosen were simply clinical remedies. There were simply remedies that covered the clinical pictures. And if there's more than one picture, you address more than one disorder. And usually you find more than one remedy to cover that. It's very, very difficult to find a single remedy that covers two different disorders that begin at a different time and two entirely different causes. And I've made this clear in some of my other publications and even giving examples of how this works out. And we can go into it if you'd like to discuss this, but this is really not directly related to the issue of specialization. I do believe that if you choose to practice clinical homeopathy, then specialization makes a lot of sense. Whereas perhaps if you feel like you can treat a patient by finding a silver bullet for that one patient, I don't think that then specialization is going to be much of an issue. Did I answer your question, Basil?
Yeah, you did. Thanks for that clarification. Yeah, it was good.
All right, I'd like to pause here a moment and ask if there's any other issues or is there anything else you'd like to discuss?
So if you're treating acutely, after you've treated acutely, you could, of course, come back to your constitutional or your general remedy, I guess.
Yes, but I wouldn't call this acutely because these are all often chronic disorders we're talking about here. The clinical disorders are...
Or the clinical disorder, yeah.
Like the nephrotic syndrome is clearly a chronic disorder. Sometimes I come into the picture after 4 or 5 years of this. And even often after the individual may have chosen a homeopathic treatment before in the classical sense and tried various constitutional remedies before, and I've collected hundreds of cases where this was the case, where well selected constitutional remedies aggravated to the point where the in some cases, treatment had to be stopped, and where in some cases, simply there was downhill. Things went downhill in the condition. So there are ways to treat clinical disorders based on the symptom picture. As Hahnemann says, the symptom, the similimum to the disorder. Similar to the disease. And if we are specializing in specific disorders, then that approach can come very handy. I did want to talk about the economics of treatment. Homeopathic treatment is, as I said, a very effective way to resolve many problems. Homeopathy can cure rheumatoid arthritis. It can cure multiple sclerosis. I've seen it cure Parkinson's disease. And I have several cases. I've got one published case. I have several cases of Parkinson's that recovered from homeopathic treatment. These cases did not recover by giving the patient a constitutional remedy, however. And when I look at the history in our journals, only some examples do you see disorders actually being treated with constitutional remedies. In most cases, the attempt was simply to match the symptoms of the syndrome. And there was at no time ever a question as to treating anything like the whole characteristics of the patient or to include into the totality of the symptoms the full characteristics of the patient. In fact, the medicines chosen are often much more limited than that, and certainly when you look at oncology, and that's the biggest area, in oncology we see, and even Hahnemann said this, Hahnemann mentioned oncology as an example, what he called a lopsided disorder. What he meant by that was there's not sufficient symptoms even present to address the disorder itself. In other words, what's a tumor? Is that the symptom? Well, no, it's not. But yes, cancer patients do have sometimes more symptoms than that. And when you look it up, under those homeopaths that actually successfully treated cancer, such as Clark is a good example, he would go into detail of the pain associated with the tumor. And so you would find a remedy that would match the modalities, for example, of the pain. But that is not there all the time. There are numerous cases, and if you've treated cancer before, there's numerous cases where cancer is simply painless. In fact, the patient doesn't even know they have cancer. The only way they know they have cancer is because they went to a routine physical. They gave them a scan or an ultrasound, and they found a tumor somewhere. Then what are their symptoms? Of course, then you come in with a constitutional remedy. However, in real life, does it work? And my answer is, no, it does not. Constitutional remedies do cure cancer in the precancerous phase. But once a tumor has developed, there's a whole new situation. And there's a definite need to address the pathology and the pathological symptoms. And it is the pathology and the pathological symptoms that are the key to the reversal of these disorders and actually the key to removing these tumors homeopathically. And I have studied, I think, what has been published, maybe 90% of the cases that have been published of cancer, homeopathic treatment of cancer. And this is consistently confirmed in the description of these cases. It is not the constitutional remedy that is curing these cases. It is, in fact, the disorder, the pathology remedy. So if one remedy does well with, let's say, prostate cancers, that same remedy may not do well with breast cancer or with gastric cancer. You actually have to look at the pathology. You have to look at the remedies in their capacity, clinical capacity, of what they can cover, what have they power over. And there's definitely evidence that specific remedies have specific range of action. And of course, now we have the help of science to determine that. There are several studies that have investigated various different remedies in vitro and have actually, in one study, they used remedies typically used for prostate cancer, and they tried them on breast cancer, and typical breast cancer, and tried them on prostate cancer. And the study confirmed that localization is important in terms of the efficacy of these remedies. In vitro, they showed efficacy in potency. So, for example, Sabal Cerulata showed efficacy for prostate cancer. On the other hand, Thuja or Thuja did not. Several other remedies had the same situation. So were confirmed to be local in terms of their effect or efficacy. This is also clearly the case in clinical descriptions of cases, published cases in homeopathy. And then on the other hand, we have people like Ramakrishnan in oncology who sees, for example, the characteristics of ligopodium, say, in a lung cancer case, and takes the patient's characteristics as indicators for treatment and reports success with that method, too. I believe there's evidence that both work in some cases. However, in my research, I found that the majority of cases in cancer actually have been treated with a disease remedy rather than with a constitutional remedy. So that would be, you could say, that would be a, that would suggest that we should if we were to treat something like cancer, that we really should specialize and learn what actually works. I believe that's true across the board. If we hope to be successful in homeopathy, I think we should understand that this is not just, homeopathy is not just a simple approach anymore in this day and age. I think we know much more about disease than they knew 200 years ago. And I think the modern scientific research on homeopathy has shown us much more about actually what homeopathy can do. For example, I thought it was interesting when the West Bengal group, like around Kuta Buksh, did multiple studies, mostly in the laboratory with mice, on homeopathic treatment of various forms of tumors and cancer. I think a total of over 20 or 30 studies. One thing they found is that a generic or general cancer remedy like carcinosin also triggered and activated biological markers across the board in these mice that indicated cancer. They were generic cancer markers. And we think of carcinosin, of course, also from clinical experience, as a very general cancer remedy, even though the remedy itself is a sarcode made from a breast cancer. And nevertheless, historically, the remedy has been described as a remedy that is effective in addressing the cancer predisposition and the precancerous state, but not so much actually the tumor stage. So when studies find that and confirm this, then this is very interesting. It would mean that there is such a thing as a general remedy for cancer or a cancer patient that fits the symptoms. The patient fits the symptoms of the remedy carcinosin. And so, correctly, I think, Dr. Ramakrishnan and others have used carcinosin as a, sometimes referred to as intercurrent, of course, that comes from the practice of the fourth and fifth edition of the Organon. Intercurrent in the sense that you still treat with C potencies, centesimal potencies, and occasional doses. However, Ramakrishnan has left that practice and gives daily doses because it works better with cancer and also with many other disorders. Hanuman himself repeated the doses in liquid form, and certainly with a new potentization scale, the so-called Q potencies, or as some people refer to them as LM potencies, that is a commonly used approach. So you repeat the remedies daily, one dose daily perhaps, or sometimes twice daily, to address the condition. And in many cases, that helps certainly symptomatically to get better improvement symptomatically because just a single dose wait and watch method doesn't help much on that level. Okay, again, I'm going to pause here. And is anybody still with us?
Yes.
Yeah, we're all here.
Yes, we're here.
Any comments, any questions?
Yes, I have a question for you on
yes.
the, for example, the case of nephrotic syndrome.
Yes.
So you were speaking about using APIS as a clinical remedy.
Yes.
But then, I'm not sure I understand, and you would use it in low potencies and repetition, correct, like a 6C in repetition. But what do you use as terrain remedy? Is that your chronic constitutional remedy?
Yes.
Or is that a no-sode remedy that you use intercurrently with?
No, it's a chronic constitutional remedy. That's sort of what Isiaga did. I actually do something slightly different. I use Q potencies or LM potencies for both.
I'll have it when I come back.
So we alternate the two remedies. We use them simultaneously, alternating. That means, let's say you start treatment, you have assessed that lycopodium is this child's constitutional remedy. It covers a lot of the constitutional characteristic. Now, lycopodium does cover some kidney disorders, but it often does not do anything in this particular disorder.
Mm-hmm.
So you would still give like a podium because you support the Constitution, the overall vital force of this patient, yet you alternate it with APIS. Let's say APIS fits the picture in this case, which it often does. I've also used terbinthina in case where there was a little blood in the urine sample, and especially when there's a right-sided picture. I've used terbinthina successfully and a few other remedies that seem to fit the clinical picture.
And you use
also,
them in alternating LM potency, from what I understood.
I'm getting a terrible echo again. Could you repeat?
I'm sorry. So, and from what I understood is you'd like to change from a C to Q potency so they wouldn't interfere as you're alternating. Is that, did I understand that correctly?
Yes. So the Q potencies have a longer duration than the centesimal potencies. And in the centesimal potencies, you're limited to the method of wait and watch. Pretty much, if you, that means you stick with one, you have to stick with one remedy pretty much for the centesimals. Ezeyak broke through that because he saw the need to go beyond that, and he was able to do it by doing high and low. So he would give like one high dose of a high 30C and daily doses of a 6C of the clinical remedy. And that one dose, occasional dose in 30C would address the terrain. What he called the terrain, he meant the issue of constitution, the vital force support of the whole patient. So in using both remedies in a Q potencies, the Q potencies last longer. In fact, one single dose of acute potency could potentially last several months, even if you give another remedy, again in a Q potency, a day later, or even a half a day later. So what I would do then is give lycopodium at night, let's say at 4 o'clock in the afternoon or at 6 o'clock in the evening, and APIS at 8 o'clock in the morning. Okay. And alternate the two, one in the morning, one at night, one in the morning, one at night, and so forth. And I've got, as I said, multiple cases cured, one case in less than 2 months, others in 8 months, and so forth, from nephrotic syndrome. So this is an example where that approach works. In other cases, I don't have the time to even address the constitution. I simply, these are the more complex cases and the more serious cases. I've come to the conclusion, and I've said this elsewhere, that the more recent disorders and the more serious disorders may need to be addressed with a remedy that only covers the disorder rather than even bothering with a constitution, which is often something that reaches back into heredity. In other words, what we are as a constitution is our heredity. So, in other words, I don't want to go back into the miasms, inherited miasms, at all. I simply want to go and address the most recent pathology. Once you get over that pathology, you address the next most recent pathology. And I'm separating them by cause, okay? So, for example, if someone got a heart attack and now has heart disease and arrhythmia, ever since after the last anesthesia, okay, which was given during a hip replacement surgery, then I am dealing with this first. Then I deal with the trauma of the hip replacement surgery. And once I remove that, then I can look at some of the stuff that's been going on prior to that, which may involve 4 or 5 more pathologies. So what I do is work myself backwards in time and trying to address the whole patient in that way. So this is an example how treating clinically I still do not specialize. I still do address everything that's there. In other words, in the end, I will get to the heredity. And you might find that there is a underlying all of this, there's a hereditary susceptibility that needs to be addressed, that I may not address for several months in treatment because it's too dangerous to address it, because it would go too deep and cause too many aggravations.
Mm-hmm.
I realize this is very different from most of what most of you are used to.
Okay.
Hello?
Yes. Yes, I understand. It's, you know, I've been in practice for about 3 years, and it's a challenge because as you're growing as a homeopath, you got to see things a little bit differently. You know, you've been taught so classically, yet sometimes you just got to look at that, as you say, just treat that and then, you know, go deeper.
I recommend, if you'd like to learn more about this, these approaches, on my website, homeopathiccollege.org. We have tutorials that go into all the details of homeopathic practice, and also applying Hahnemannian methodologies to the modern situation. Then also I've done some lectures that cover individual topics of this.
Okay.
We had someone else make have questions or comments before. Could you?
Yeah. Can I address the business aspect of specialization?
Yes.
This is Michelle Muller from Teleosis. I have found I'm a massage therapist at a local hospital here, as well as a homeopathic student, and I have found that specializing for me in massage therapy was extremely beneficial business-wise. I work at the birth center at the hospital, so I do a lot of prenatal massage, labor massage, postpartum. And I also specialize in deep tissue massage, especially for orthopedic issues.
Mm-hmm.
We do a lot of hip and knee replacement things at the hospital.
Right.
But by specializing in those two things, within my first year of being at that hospital, and I've been there for 11 years now, I was booked 5 days a week.
Yes, I know.
Just through word of mouth.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in the Hudson Valley, we have a high incidence of Lyme disease, which is one of the things homeopathically I'm interested in specializing in, mostly because there's a lot of people around here suffering with that.
Right.
But also because there's a demand for it.
Yes.
And if you do have success, if, you know, you're good at what you do and you do have success at it.
Correct.
The word tends to spread very quickly, and you can build a practice, you know, relatively quickly.
Yes.
So I think there is a benefit in specializing.
I agree. And I actually think the future of homeopathic practice will be actually specializing homeopathic practice. That doesn't mean there won't be some generalist homeopaths around. There always will be those, I think. But I do think one survey recently found that homeopaths in North America are still not making the kind of money they deserve. When you think about the enormous amount of training, and sometimes that's even in addition to conventional medical professional training, if someone comes from conventional medicine and then finds homeopathy, or if a nurse decides to learn homeopathy, or a midwife, or even a naturopath chooses homeopathy as their, you could say, specialty in a sense. But when you look at the income that these people are getting from their practice, it's in the 70,000 range, I understand. And for some, it's even less than that. And that is not good enough to justify the enormous training. And, of course, we train constantly, and you will train for the rest of your life because there's always more to learn, more to know. So my thinking is this. I think the currently, based on my observations, on discussions with students, and other homeopaths, I think the homeopathic practice, 4 days a week, let's say, decide to work 4 days a week, should easily be able to bring $250,000 to $300,000 a year. And that means that you see many patients or clients. And I use client because for legal reasons for in some states, et cetera. So we're not there yet. I do think that specialization would be one way for many homeopaths to get there. Like you said, it took you probably a few months to realize that you're going to be full-time busy.
Right.
I've heard this from others. I know a woman who specialized in autism. I know another person who specialized in childhood attention deficit and hyperactivity disorder. And both were so busy that they could not, they had to turn away patients, pretty much.
Right.
So I do think, go ahead.
I think that if you look around your area where you live, you know, if you live in Florida and you're dealing, you know, you have a high population of elderly patients with skin cancers or arthritic conditions, and, you know, of course you have to do something you're interested in or what's the point. But, you know, knowing what the demand is in your area, you know, is research that you need to do to really have that be successful.
Yes. I myself always have been reluctant to specialize because I found myself interested in so many things. One thing that was my problem is I have an inquiring mind and I'll always think outside the box. And I find other approaches and other solutions from the standard approach. It includes also homeopathy. So, for example, also the medical science. I'm sure you know that many homeopaths are to some degree at odds with what's considered normal and normal and is assumed as fact in mainstream medicine. Well, homeopathy from the very beginning was a kind of rebellion against the conventional points of views. Well, these conventional points of views, of course, have changed as medical science has advanced. And we have different beliefs today. So, for example, one reason why one disorder becomes more fashionable, more common, is often because of some new theory, some advancement in diagnostic technology or simply a new designation like Novartis, I understand, came up with the term hyperactivity and attention deficit disorder. And
yeah.
They did so because they were looking for something that they could use their already existing drug, Ritalin.
Listen to the end of the show.
Once you understand that, then you may look at disorders differently. But still, people will be looking for solutions in specific areas. You were mentioning Lyme's disease. Lyme's disease can be diagnosed and is being diagnosed more and more. And you could say it's in a way kind of a fad diagnosis. In fact, I found out that many cases diagnosed with Lyme's disease actually do not have Lyme's disease.
Yeah.
And a lot of
cases not diagnosed with Lyme disease do have some tick-borne disease.
Well, I mean, the question is the mechanism.
No, honey, you have to wait. You're supposed to be in bed.
Okay.
Hello?
Maybe somebody should use their mute button.
Oh, yes. Sorry.
No problem. So, for example, Dr. Dietrich Klinghardt has been somewhat of a pioneer in Lyme's research, and he found connections even before he got into Lyme's with chronic infections. He found he referred to it at times as the Klinghardt theorem, even though he didn't come up with it. It was actually Dr. Rao in Switzerland that developed the theory that the body actually defends itself against the heavy metal mercury by creating an infectious, chronic infectious culture, and then places the mercury into the nucleus of whatever microbe it can maintain. And that is the reason for the chronic infection. Now, how should we think of this as homeopaths? Well, I thought of it in terms of removing the cause. The cause actually is the mercury. So we actually need to learn how to remove the mercury. And, of course, there's methods that are workable methods that have been tried clinically and are working for people to remove mercury. And at the same time, we need to stimulate the patient's resistance and susceptibility to the infection. And gradually, as the mercury is being removed, they no longer need the infection. And the immune system will let go. And I've seen this in multiple cases resolve the condition that was diagnosed as chronic Lyme's disease. It is amazing how completely and thoroughly people recover from this disorder in a matter of a year when you do that.
Interesting.
So this is just one example of many. I've seen the same thing in AIDS, and I've seen the same thing in chronic polio. So what's known as post-polio syndrome is actually a chronic form of polio that's held in place.
So thank you, Manfred. I'm going to stop the recording, but we can continue having our conversation.
Okay.
So I think it'll announce when it's done.
Very good. Thank you, Myra.